on KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The American economy today is utterly dominated by massive companies that have monopolies on what we eat, wear, drive, bank, shop, and consume. When recessions hit in the modern era, our tax dollars bail out corporations that we are told are, quote, too big to fail. My next guest has written a powerful book about corporate monopolies in which he explains how big business destroyed the American dream. Tom Hartman is a renowned progressive radio talk show host, New York Times bestselling author who's written more than 24 books, including several that are part of his new Hidden History series. His latest book, with a foreword by Ralph Nader, is called The Hidden History of Monopolies, How Big Business Destroyed the American Dream. Welcome to the program, Tom.
Thanks, Sonali. Great to be here with you.
Your book is, of course, historical, and you've been writing this series of history books. That is your one of your main expertises. And the issue of monopolies and their function in capitalism is one that plays a role in the history of the U.S. Tell me how it was that when the nation itself was being formed, when the founding fathers were crafting the infrastructure of this nation, it was actually a battle against monopoly.
Yeah. The story that most of us hear is that the Boston Tea Party happened because of taxation without representation, because the colonists didn't like the fact that the British had raised the tax on tea. All of that is not true. The East India Company was the largest monopoly in the world. It was started in December of 1601 by Queen Elizabeth I. Most of the stock was held by the aristocracy of the UK. And most of the members of the House of Lords and many members of the House of Commons. And 170 years later, it was, this sprawling business empire all over the world. And they had been given an absolute exclusive right to import a whole lot of different things into the United States, from fine clothing to tools and weapons. But the big one was tea. Back in those days, the two main drugs that were used in the colonies were alcohol and caffeine. Bars were pretty much just for men and only open in the evening. But the venues that were open all day and well into the evenings and almost every city block in big cities like Boston were tea houses. And about half of these tea houses were buying their tea from smugglers who were bringing it into the country, not the East India Company, which was illegal. You had to buy it from the East India Company. But the smugglers offered decent prices. So anyhow, in 1770, there was a worldwide depression, or at least a depression that hit the colonies and the United Kingdom really, really hard. And so the East India Company went to their stockholders, the Parliament, and said, or the stockholders in the Parliament, and said, "We are desperately in need of cash. We're having a serious problem here." Now, back then, the way that companies like the East India Company paid the tax on tea was when they took it into inventory. So when they took 1 million pounds of inventory in from India into the United Kingdom as tea inventory, unsold inventory, that was when they paid the tax. So they had tens of millions of dollars, millions of pounds of tea in the UK that they had already paid taxes on. So what Parliament did with the Tea Acts of 1773 is they said, "We're going to rebate all of that tax money to you. You no longer have to pay any taxes on tea, or a very, very low tax rate, largely irrelevant tax rate. We're going to give you this money as cash to keep you, solvent and afloat and to help you out in the colonies." The East India Company then used that now low-priced tea, not untaxed tea, which was what the smuggler tea was, they could compete. And they even dropped the price further using the cash they got to try to drive the smugglers out of business, which was driving out of business all these small tea shops up and down the East Coast. And the American colonists were like really seriously pissed off that this giant corporation was trying to pull a Walmart, coming into their community with giant tax breaks and then undercutting their local businesses. And that's why the Boston Tea Party happened in 1773. It was a fight against monopoly.
So from that, what were the restrictions, the regulations put into place to ensure that such a thing wouldn't happen again?
Well, we had another major experience with monopoly. Basically, you know, once we got rid of the East India Company, there were no companies in North America large enough to have, you know, to play a major monopoly role. And the railroads had not yet come along, so, you know, commerce was still local. But in the South, starting in the 1820s in a big way, right around 1800 to 1810, the invention of the cotton gin was it was in the late 1890s, and the cotton gin gave a plantation the ability to clean as much cotton as could be done by 50 people in the same amount of time. And so what you had was an explosion of you know, very similar to what happened here in the 80s when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act in the agriculture field with farm aid and all that. What you had then was that all of the small farmers across the South were basically put out of business and bought out by the large plantations. And so a new kind of monopoly arose that really seriously seized political power by 1820 with John C. Calhoun. And by 1860, had become basically a fascistic police state run by you know, a handful of large plantations. And that's what brought us into the Civil War, which broke them up. Our next experience of monopoly was in the late 1800s as industrialization was happening. And John Rockefeller owned, you know, something like 90% of the total oil business, and Andrew Carnegie over 90% of the steel business, and you know, three or four oligarchs who owned the railroads. You had DuPont and Dow with explosives and chemicals. And so Congress said, you know, we've got to do something about this. We're heading in the direction of the East India Company 100 years ago. And so they passed the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1890, which made this kind of activity illegal. It didn't get enforced, though, until around 1905, when Teddy Roosevelt was basically shamed into it by his political opponents. But that was when we got our immune system to monopolies, and they were largely regulated and controlled up until 1982-83, which is when Ronald Reagan officially told the Department of Commerce, the Department of Justice, and the SEC to stop enforcing those laws.
Right. Let's talk about that history. Fast forward to 1981. Reagan is inaugurated. You write that his inauguration speech is, you know, continues today to be one of the most popular presidential speeches among conservatives. And in that, explain what it was that he outlined in a way that is somehow so attractive to conservatives that it persists today and has come to define how we look at corporations and businesses.
Conservative, historically, I mean, go back and read Russell Kirk, 1951, The Conservative Mind, the book that kicked off the modern conservative movement. His first chapter is about Edmund Burke in the 1770s. Thomas Paine spent 2 weeks at his house on his way to France to get arrested in the French Revolution and was so angry with Burke that he wrote an entire book rebutting him called The Rights of Man. So, you know, a word that you could use to describe conservative is aristocrat. The conservative movement from the 1800s, from the 1700s until this day has always been a movement for consolidation of power among a small class of very wealthy people. And so when And what these people know is that there's only one force in the world that has the power to say to an oil refinery down the block from you, you may not pollute these people's home, or a coal mine, you may not dump your waste in the river. The only power, or a bank, you may not rip off your customers. The only power in the world that can restrain that kind of essentially evil behavior by corporations is government. And so conservatives and aristocrats and, you know, fat cats and billionaires and giant polluting corporations were delighted when Reagan said in that first inaugural address, the government is not the solution to your problems. Government, in fact, is the problem. And I'm paraphrasing, but you know, this has become the mantra for the Reagan Revolution for the last 40 years. No Democratic president has reversed it. No Democratic Congress has reversed it. We've been living in trickle-down economics, Reaganomics, supply-side economics, whatever you want to call it, and not just an economic system, but a political system as well that deregulates and has allowed monopolies to just explode across the country. The American business landscape in the 1990s was so different, and today so different from what it was literally just a year before Reagan came into office in the 70s.
So this idea that government is the problem, that if we reduce the size of government, it is somehow going to benefit all of us. How is that used as a way to then, attack government? So you reduce the power of government, you make it less effective. And when it's less effective, you say, look, government is problematic. But of course, it's that conservative mindset that caused the problems with government efficiency in the first place.
Yeah, what you're describing is what David Stockman referred to as the Star of the Beast strategy in the Reagan White House. He was Reagan's budget director. And, you know, he laid it out pretty clearly that the goal of conservatives was to break government. I mean, you know, Steve Bannon in 2016 said that the major job of the Trump administration, if he was elected president, would be to, quote, deconstruct the administrative state, which is, you know, geek speak for tear down the American government. And Reagan said, you know, essentially the same thing. And the way that you starve the beast is, for example, Social Security. You want people not to like the Social Security Administration. You want them to think that it's, you know, badly run bureaucracy, so that they will call for, you know, Citibank or Bank of America to take over Social Security, which Republicans have been calling for since the 1930s, actually. And so what you do is you cut back on its staff. And this is something that's been going on since Reagan. Trump just put it into overdrive. He offered early retirement to 20,000 Social Security employees. And, you know, you cut their staff. And so now it can take up to, it takes more than 2 years just to get a Social Security disability claim processed. And then typically they turn it down and you've got to come back two or three times. Because their staff has been eviscerated. The IRS, Trump cut back on the IRS's staff by some 15 or 20,000 people. And as a result of that, the Internal Revenue Service is no longer auditing very wealthy people like Donald Trump. They're just auditing small people and small businesses because those kinds of audits, you know, they want to have high numbers. We did, 1,000 audits this month. And those kind of audits can be done quickly and easily. So, and of course, David Koch ran for vice president in 1980 on the platform of abolishing the IRS. And so, you know, Trump is doing his work. So that's what you're describing, Sonali, is the Star of the Beast strategy. It has been, embedded in Republican philosophy since 1980, and every Republican president has aggressively pursued it.
How has this ideology been maintained through effective and slick propaganda so that the very people that are hurt by monopolies, by corporate behemoths, tout them and see them as the way to promote equality? I mean, it's like we live in an Orwellian world.
Yeah. In 1933, when Franklin Roosevelt became president, and the business community at that point was not held in high favor because we were 3 years into the Great Depression. And he went right after the business community head on, and he said, they hate me and I welcome their hatred. And he called them out constantly. And he had a commission that Harry Truman chaired when he was a senator, looking into the possibility of war millionaires and things like this. So the business community in America had gotten pretty badly beaten up in the 30s and early 40s. And as a result, they became apolitical. Let's just keep our heads down and do business. That's what we do. And in 1971, Lewis Powell wrote a memo to his neighbor and friend, Eugene Sindor Jr., who was the chairman or president or whatever his title was of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And in that memo, he said, we have to get political. He was a lawyer for the tobacco industry at the time. We representatives of industry and billionaires in the United States, back then it was multimillionaires, have to get political. We have to build an infrastructure of think tanks that can put out our ideas and that can disparage the communist socialist ideas of the New Deal, of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, and of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. And in addition to that, we need to develop, an agency that can funnel judges into federal courts. We need to seize control of the econ departments and political science departments of universities around the country. We need to buy our own or build our own media infrastructure. We need to be changing the textbooks in the schools, in the high schools across the country. I mean, it was just a multi-level, multi-factor, super detailed plan for basically a right-wing takeover of America. And it so inspired billionaires, right-wing billionaires like the Koch brothers, that, you know, within 3 years, you had the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, the Economic Policy, or the Competitive Enterprise Institute. You know, it just went on and on and on, right? The Federalist Society, that gave us, you know, over 300 federal judges here in the last 4 years. And they built out this infrastructure. And now, I mean, I was visiting one of these think tanks back about 10 years ago in Washington, D.C., when I was living there and doing my show there. And the guy showing me around, it didn't know much about me. He was just, you know, the intern who was charged with giving people tours. And we walked through this basement room, and there was like 15 or 20 people on computers there. Every single one of their computers was on Wikipedia. They were editing Wikipedia pages constantly, you know, with a grant from some billionaire. Wow. And it's just like, this is the new reality in America. If you're trying to search up something, you know, like the New Deal or the Great Depression or tariffs, or, I mean, you know, pick some random thing that you would think is just totally wonky. When you plug that into a search engine, the first 20, 30 hits you're going to get are all going to be right-wing think tank produced stuff or newspaper articles produced by people who are funded by them. And of course, Heritage, as Ken Vogel pointed out in Politico 4 or 5 years ago, Heritage has been given $1 million a year to Rush Limbaugh, $1 million a year to Sean Hannity. They support this right-wing infrastructure. There is literally nothing comparable to that on the left.
Wow. So with the money that they have minted from maintaining corporate monopolies, they have funded propaganda to convince us that monopolies are good for all of us.
That's correct. And one of the main ways they did this, and this is my previous book, The Hidden History of the Supreme Court and the Betrayal of America, in 1976, you know, this was still kind of a pipe dream by these billionaires. Even seizing political power was a pipe dream. The John Birch Society was considered crackpot. Now they're considered moderate. You know, Lewis Powell, the guy who wrote the memo in 71, was put on the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon in 72. And so in 76, they had this case, Buckley versus Vallejo, before them. And the decision that they made in that case was that for the first time in American history, all the way back to 1787, for the first time in American history, if a wealthy person it's in 76, it was just wealthy people. If a billionaire wants to own a politician or a number of politicians so completely that that politician, virtually everything they do is for the benefit of that particular billionaire, that would have historically been called corruption, or, you know, which would bring you at the very least ethics charges, or bribery, which could get you put in jail. In 76, the Supreme Court ruled, no, that's neither. That money is not actually money. It's free speech. And so this is simply rich people exercising their rights of free speech. 2 years later, in 78, in a decision that Lewis Powell wrote in a case called First National Bank versus Bilotti, the Supreme Court ruled that logic from the Buckley decision in 76, now in 78, we're going to apply that to companies as well, in this case, the First National Bank of Boston. And so what that did was enabled an absolute waterfall of money to pour in 1979 and 1980 into the Reagan campaign and into Republican campaigns all across the country. Democrats largely didn't take that money at the time because they were well funded by the unions. That all changed within 10 years, which is a whole another story. But this is how we got here, and this is how they seized this political power. And then, you know, of course, in 2010 with Citizens United, they doubled down on it.
You referred earlier in our conversation to the sort of immune system that needs to kick in, or that did kick in our history to right the ship and to break up monopolies. How can that immune system, democracy's immune system, as you call it in your book, be invoked today?
Well, I think first to understand the metaphor. All of us in our bodies every day, there are cells that mutate in ways that are not, you know, appropriate. And as a result, we have precancerous cells. Our body has an immune system that finds those cells and destroys them. And every now and then one slips through. And when that one cell slips through the immune system, it starts setting up shop and saying, I, Claudius, you know, I'm going to take all the energy from this body and direct it to me. And they develop their own vascular systems, and they get bigger and bigger and bigger and more cells. And we call that cancer. And it sucks all the energy out of the body, and people shrivel up and die, basically. Well, monopolies are to capitalism what cancer is to our bodies, to biology. And in the as we talked about earlier, by the 1890s, we were seeing for the first time in America, since we'd kicked out the East India Company, for the first time in all of America, we were seeing massive monopolies that not only had huge economic power. The key to a monopoly, the main purpose of a monopoly is to prevent competition, and they were very effective at doing that. But they also had incredible political power because they were so wealthy. And so in 1890, we passed the Sherman Antitrust Act to say this is illegal, as I mentioned earlier. That's our immune system. And Reagan, basically gave us AIDS. You know, when people get a virus that kills the immune system, what comes out of that? Kaposi sarcoma, cancer. People get cancer from AIDS. People get cancer. And our body politic and body economic has now got the monopoly cancer. There is literally not a single industry in America now that is not basically functioning as a monopoly. I mean, the actual technical term would be oligopoly, because it's typically between 3 and 5 companies that control more than 80% of an individual sector. But they act in concert. I mean, if United raises their prices $10, Delta does the next, 5 minutes later, because their computers are constantly monitoring each other. So they act as monopolies. And this has just devastated America.
So the one of the things that you talk about in your book is breaking up the tech monopolies, the tech giants that have monopolized that industry. Why is that an important aspect of addressing today's monopolies?
Well, for the same reason, that all monopolies are cancerous in both politically and economically. We need to have the ability of small businesses, entrepreneurs, small businesses, medium-sized businesses, to not only survive but to start. To come into being. In 1960, I was a little kid. I was 9 years old. And this TV show came out. It was called Route 66. Back then, the Eisenhower highway system was still under construction. And the only way you could get from New York to Los Angeles was on Route 66. It was a 2-lane highway that went all the way across the United States and went through hundreds of little towns. And in this TV show, every week, George Maharis and Martin Milner would, they were driving a Corvette across the country, and every week they'd be in a different town. And you always knew where they were. They're in Biloxi, Mississippi. Oh, there's the Biloxi Diner and the Biloxi Bank and the Biloxi Hotel and family-owned businesses, Jacobson's Furniture and Johnson's, restaurant or whatever it may be. And that was because we had anti-monopoly laws that prevented for example, banks couldn't do business across state lines. A lot of hotel chains could not do. It was very difficult to do business across state lines. The monopoly laws kept business local. And thus, when Franklin Roosevelt or Lyndon Johnson wanted to stimulate the economy by putting money into the pockets of people at the bottom, the economic bottom, they would spend that money in their local community. They'd go to the local, diner, and it was family owned. That fine diner would be buying from the local farmer. The money would circulate in the community. Now people go to Walmart. Walmart every night pushes a button. The money all goes to Arkansas. And then the next morning, that money all goes to China. So even our stimulus doesn't work. So at virtually every level, monopolies are destroying the business landscape of this country. And the tech giants have been at the lead of using John Rockefeller's strategy back in the 1880s, 1890s. What Rockefeller did is he would go to his competitors and say, I'm going to run you out of business, but I'll provide you with an alternative. I'll buy your company. Just sell me your stock. I'll give you a little bit of my stock. You'll get rich. I'll get rich and everything will be great. And that's how he put together the Standard Oil Company. Well, that's basically what Facebook has done with Instagram and dozens of other companies. Mm. And it's not healthy. It's not healthy for our economy.
And of course, these tech companies control so much of our discourse, which is, in turn riddled with this idea that big business is good, government is bad. It sort of all feeds into one another, and they are the unelected arbiters of our truth and the information that we share with one another.
Yes. Yeah. And that's an example of how monopoly doesn't just destroy competition, small businesses, and local economies. It also destroys political diversity.
Well, Tom, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Can't wait to see what book is next in your Hidden History series.
Thanks. Up next is The Hidden History of Oligarchy and Tyranny in America. I think you'll like it.
I'm sure I will. Good luck to you, Tom. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
My guest has been Tom Hartmann, renowned progressive radio talk show host, New York Times bestselling author who's written more than 24 books, including several that are part of his new Hidden History series. And we've been discussing the latest book in that series, The Hidden History of Monopolies, How Big Business Destroyed the American Dream. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.